you see the shapes of the world. Your creative style is based off of how you see these shapes. And remember, there's validity in that. There's a whole force motivating your own creativity. The way that you see the world is how you're meant to see the world. So, how do you see the world?
That was just Tommy Kozak-Kiewicz, and he's a part of Tozak Filming. He's an artist pursuing filmmaking, music, and the spirituality of creativity. And his goal in life is to help people unlock the creativity within themselves. This connects perfectly to our topic and what we will be talking about today, because he talks about noticing the smaller shapes in nature and the importance of all of what surrounds you. Hi, I'm Ava Webster.
I'm Sean Nader.
And I'm Alejandro Verduzco.
And welcome to our podcast on nature through art.
Today, we'll take you on a trip in exploring nature as art. Our first stop will be exploring the historical background of seeing nature as art through the Hudson River School. Then, we'll go to a Carl Stirner Art Trail near Lafayette. Finally, we'll travel to upstate New York to visit the Storm King Art Center and talk about one of its sculptures. The key topic we'll cover today is seeing nature as art, how art is seen in nature, how art imitates nature, and how humans idolize nature through art. The Hudson River School was widely regarded as the first art movement in America. Before the movement, artists seemed more interested in doing portraits than painting landscapes. Those who were interested in landscapes looked into Europe for styles and techniques on the subject. After the American Revolution, the movement grew to a large amount of majestic wilderness left in America. Under Romanticism, a movement focusing on emotion, nature, and the sublime, and nationalism, loyalty and devotion to the nation, nature was something the young nation could uniquely uphold with pride. The movement is characterized by their realistic and idealistic portrayals of nature. The Hudson River School contributed largely in helping Americans appreciate nature and the wilderness that was untouched by man. But they also celebrated the middle ground between civilization and the wilderness to glorify progress and praise westward expansion. The founder, Thomas Cole, produced several images of the Hudson River that attracted the attention of the art world. In particular, there's one painting I'd like to discuss, which is Sunny Morning on the Hudson River. The painting takes place in the morning, hence the name, with the sun emerging. In the sky, there's a decent amount of clouds with bright yellow sunlight slowly emerging from the horizon, contrasting with the blue sky. There are broken trees blowing in the wind in the foreground, with dry patches of dirt and grass around. In the middle ground, there's large dark mountains, providing a nice contrast with the overall vibrant colors of the foreground and background. In said background, there's a river flowing into the horizon. The foreground is dominated by an orange tint, while the background is largely dark green to blue tinted.
So how does the painting showcase the Hudson River movement overall?
Yeah, so the painting showcases nature and the sublime. Sublime in this context refers to a sense of awe at nature's grandeur. The mountain and the broken trees suggest the sublime. Both are created by some immense power. Yet the overall feeling of the painting is not one of fright. Rather, the gentle clouds emerging, morning and soothing blue of the sky creates a feeling of calm and peacefulness. The painting creates this idealistic, pleasing place of quiet contemplation, said depictions were common in the movement.
Lastly, how does this painting connect to nature and art, the overall question?
So, the painting represents art imitating nature. First, the painting is very realistic. It's almost as if the painting were a photo of the landscape. Cole was inspired by the Hudson River and created the painting in order to capture the beauty of the valley and nature by extension. In addition, the painting is an idealized view of nature. Thus, The painting showcases how we use art in order to portray this perfect image of nature and attempt to capture its beauty. Yet, what we create is only a glimpse, an invitation of nature's true beauty.
Now, we will transition from talking about having an idealized view of nature through the perspective of the painting Sunday Morning to traveling to the Carl Serner's Arch Trail, which is located right along Bushkill Creek in Easton, Pennsylvania, to talk about the smaller details in nature through an example of a sculpture named Freebridge.
So, Ava, can you tell us a little bit about the sculpture? Like, what was it and who made it and what's going on with it?
Yeah, so the sculpture is right off the Carl Serner's Arch Trail and is made out of all of painted steel, and the whole thing kind of looks like a frame or a shell of a bridge that's been picked up and dropped onto this trail.
Like an actual bridge?
Sort of. It's more like an outline of one. So at the base, there are two big steel legs that are angled, and together they make this triangular shape. And they start out really sturdy at the bottom, and as they go up, they get more narrow. So this makes it feel like it's stretching up towards something and reaching towards something.
Oh, cool. What connects the two legs?
So there's a horizontal steel bar across the top, and that's where the sunlight really comes into play for this sculpture. So when the sun hits it at the right angle, it can cast a shadow of the Northampton Bridge onto a round disc that's hanging in the middle of the sculpture.
Wait, so there's a shadow of the whole bridge on the disc? That sounds super intentional.
It totally is, but I didn't get to see it at all when I saw the sculpture.
And why not?
Because when I went to see it, it was a cloudy and rainy day, so the sculpture didn't activate, basically, and it kind of hit me that I was missing what might be the whole point of this piece in sculpture. And it made me think about how easy it is to overlook these small details and how nature literally decides what we can or cannot see.
That actually connects to something we talked about earlier, the Hudson River School. Did that come to mind for you?
Yeah, totally. The Hudson River School artists were all about noticing tiny details in nature and treating them like they mattered. And this sculpture does the same thing. Its meaning comes from the subtle shadow that only appears when the sunlight is perfect. It's like nature becomes part of the artwork.
So would you say the sculpture is an example of seeing nature through art?
Yes, absolutely. The sculpture needs the sunlight and nature to represent itself fully. So even though it's man-made, it depends on nature to complete the experience. So without the sun and without the nature, you're only seeing half of the sculpture. As we now leave the Carl Serner's Arch Trail, where we learned about the importance of smaller details in nature, we will continue our journey to learn more about how art mimics nature with a sculpture called Fallen Sky at the Storm King Art Center. So to begin, can you give us a description and a visual of what this sculpture looks like?
Yeah, sure. It's kind of a bunch of different pieces of mirrors on a side hill. There's kind of a larger one in the middle and some others laid kind of next to it in a crescent shape. And those mirrors are pointed up at the sky.
So how do these features of this sculpture enhance what nature means for the viewer?
I felt like it was meant to show nature in an almost hallowed environment. It made me feel like a lot of otherworldly sense. It was mostly because the reflection was unobstructed, so you could see the sky in what almost felt like a tangible way, like you could reach out and touch it and grab it. And that honestly made me feel more connected to nature and feel like it was right there in front of me.
Does this artwork depend on the weather or the daytime at all?
In a sense, yes, it does. If you want to see a mostly unobstructed, not unobstructed, but a clear effect, then it would be best to go on a clear day where there aren't going to be any clouds or anything to give away that it's, a reflection. But even with clouds and with rain, the effect's still going to be there. So as long as it's not like pouring rain or, you know, there's snow out covering the mirror, it should be fine.
Yeah, like no matter what, it's still gonna give you the effect of like the nature around you.
Yeah, yeah.
And like show you everything that it has to offer.
Yeah, that's right.
And then how does this sculpture relate to Hudson River School movement that we were talking about earlier?
Yeah, so this artwork, it's pretty stylized in the sense that it shows the sky in an unorthodox way with mirrors. It's kind of similar to how the Hudson River School, with all their paintings, it seemed very stylized and kind of an artistic interpretation of what nature was to them. It showed a lot of emotion because of the dramatic scenery, having a pretty deep respect for nature to show such an unobstructed, clear view into nature and just how it makes the viewer feel as well.
Yeah, and I feel like also it like shows this like idealized view of nature that we were talking about earlier with the Hudson River School, and just how like the nature is the art in this like perspective, like in this sculpture, it's literally showing nature through the art.
Yeah, no, definitely. With it being a reflection, it literally does show nature through art.
Mm-hmm. And then lastly, how does this sculpture relate to nature being seen through art? We kind of touched upon that
We did. But yeah, no, to say again, it shows how nature is art, with a lot of its landscapes and intricate, like, natural colors. You can go out into, like, on a trail and see that it's art just by looking at it. And so this highlights that just by showing the sky in your present moment in a way that makes you feel closer to nature.
All right. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Unfortunately, we reached the end of our trip. We have talked a lot on this podcast, but what is most important is that art and nature are closely intertwined. However, the extent of which depends a lot on the artist and the artwork itself.
Seeing nature through art is important because it slows us down and helps us to notice the beauty that we'd normally overlook. Art creates an emotional connection to the natural world and shows us a new perspective and reminds us that we are a part of nature and not separate from it. Instead of just describing what nature looks like, art can help us understand why it matters, which helps turn a simple landscape or moment or even a sculpture into a meaningful experience.
Thank you, Alejandro, Ava, and Sean. Nature and art can truly be anything from a painting of a landscape to a more intricate sculpture using nature as a tool in its construction that totally changes its appearance based on factors such as weather. I would like to now introduce our next group, Max and Riley, who will be discussing knowing nature through science. Science opens up a whole new world that allows us to analyze and learn more about how the universe truly works, and they will be highlighting how this subject can make us more curious about the mysterious lore of nature.
The learned astronomer, when the proofs, the figures, were ranged in columns before me, I wandered off by myself, in the mystical moist night air, looked up in perfect silence at the stars. That was a quote from Walt Whitman. Hi, I'm Riley Cohen.
And I'm Max Mahler. Today we're exploring something that seems simple, but gets more complicated the deeper we go. What does it mean, really mean, to know nature, and how does science shape that knowledge?
So, does science affect how you view nature?
I would say no.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
Yeah. Yes, I would say so.
We're going to be using ideas from Carl Sagan, Charles Dickens, Edward O. Wilson, Henry David Thoreau, and Friedrich Nietzsche to try to understand whether science helps us appreciate nature or if it risks turning nature into something cold and lifeless.
Before we talk about nature, science, we have to ask, what even is nature? When you first think about it, it seems obvious: trees, rivers, animals, mountains.
Yeah, but once you start thinking about it a little longer, definition starts falling apart. A city park is trees and grass, but it's man-made. A computer is man-made, but it's made out of natural materials.
So maybe nature isn't about what something is made of, but how it came into being. Nature is everything that arises from processes outside of human control or intention.
I like that definition. It means nature is shaped by randomness, chaos, and other powerful forces that don't really care about us or answer to us.
And defining nature this way sets us up for the real question. What does it mean to know something that wasn't created for us, doesn't respond to us, and exists independently of us?
If you think about it, to know anything usually means understanding why it is the way it is. Like knowing that rain happens because water vapor condenses, or knowing that leaves change color because chlorophyll breaks down.
But that raises the question, does understanding the mechanisms mean we know the thing itself? For example, salt. We can say salt is NaCl, but then we can ask what is sodium and what is chlorine. Then, what are atoms, what are electrons, and what are quarks?
It turns into an infinite staircase of explanations.
Exactly, and that's where Carl Sagan steps in. In Can We Know the Universe, Sagan asks, can we know ultimately and in detail a grain of salt?
And the answer is complicated. We can know something about it, but the deeper we go, the more nature opens up. A grain of salt turns into molecules. Molecules turn into atoms. Atoms turn into subatomic particles. And then quantum mechanics shows up and collapses our entire sense of certainty.
Sagan argues that instead of making nature less meaningful, this infinite depth actually makes it more interesting. There is no final layer of truth, but every layer reveals something amazing.
So it seems then, rather than killing mystery, science creates more of it. Whitman walked away from the astronomer's charts because they overwhelmed him. But perhaps Sagan would say those charts show that nature is more complicated and nuanced than we ever imagined. However, it does seem that there is a point where science goes too far, or at least risks reducing nature to something bland and lifeless.
Charles Dickens gives us the perfect example in Hard Times. When the characters define a horse, Bitzer recites the perfect scientific description. Diet, teeth, hooves, classification.
And yet, by the end of it, you're left thinking, that says nothing about what a horse actually is. There's no sense of movement or beauty or relationship. It's just raw data.
Dickens warns us that facts without feelings can distort reality. If nature becomes only numbers and definitions, we lose its meaning. Friedrich Nietzsche offers a similar perspective on science. He says that science does not reveal objective truths. It reveals interpretations. He famously wrote, "There are no facts, only interpretations."
Nietzsche defines science as the experience of men for their instincts and the instinct to know their instincts.
Nietzsche isn't anti-science, however. He just reminds us that science is only one perspective on nature, not the whole picture.
Which means understanding nature requires more than just facts. It also takes experience, curiosity, and the ability to see beyond the definitions. Edward O. Wilson offers a different perspective on this idea in The Bird of Paradise. He describes the stunning male emperor of Germany, a bird of paradise with bright colors, elaborate dances, and an unreal appearance.
Some people say that breaking this beauty into biology, muscles, genetics, behavior, destroys the magic of nature.
But Wilson rejected that. He says science is synthetic, meaning it doesn't just take things apart, but it puts meaning back together.
Every discovery leads to more questions. Studying a bird doesn't destroy its beauty, it multiplies it. Why does it dance? How did it evolve? What challenges shaped it?
Wilson believes science deepens our appreciation of nature by showing us how improbable, interconnected, and interesting it really is.
Henry David Thoreau takes this even further. According to Rebecca Neal Guild, Thoreau believed that nature wasn't just something to be analyzed, it was something to learn from. Nature had moral lessons, spiritual lessons, and personal lessons.
Thoreau walked, observed, sketched, took detailed notes on ponds, trees, and animals. He was a self-taught naturalist, as Gould would say.
But he never lost his sense of awe. He saw scientific detail and spiritual meaning as partners, not enemies.
Gould describes how Thoreau blended rigorous observation with deep curiosity. He proves it's possible to understand nature and still feel wonder towards it at the same time.
So, does science affect how you view nature?
I would say no, because you're not destroying the nature.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. Science proves that the world's getting hotter and the oceans are becoming more acidic. Science proves global warming.
Yes, I would say so, because I think just throughout life, learning about science, I feel like it's the most reliable way to view our planet and to view like, the processes that happen on our planet.
Yeah, I also think that science alters how I, like my view on nature. I think it gives like evidence.
So where does this leave us all? Does science help us know nature, or does it risk flattening it?
Maybe both. We've seen that science can break nature into pieces, but we've also seen its ability to reveal the hidden connections and inner workings that nature may be hiding.
Sagan teaches us that every explanation opens doors to deeper mystery. Dickens and Nietzsche warn us that not to mistake definitions for meaning. Wilson argues that science can rebuild wonder, and Thoreau shows us that nature and awe can coexist.
So maybe the goal isn't absolute knowledge, rather it's balanced knowledge. Enough understanding to appreciate nature, but just enough humility to remain curious.
We'll leave you with this thought from William Blake: to see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wildflower.
Thanks for listening. And remember, science may help us see nature clearly, but curiosity is the passion behind that driving force.
What technology are you currently using?
My iPhone.
I am currently using my phone.
Currently using a TV.
A phone and a watch.
My computer.
And do you feel disconnected with nature by using this technology?
I don't think so. I think it's a useful tool, but I don't think I'm less connected.
I don't, because I spend most of my time on my phone reading. So I actually feel more connected because I get to read when I'm on my phone.
No, not necessarily. I think I spend enough time in nature and to, you know, sit back, relax, watching TV. It's not that big of a deal. Don't feel that disconnected.
Yes, because like usually I'm doing my work and it's like in my room, not in nature.
I think my phone does, but my watch doesn't because it only gives me the time.
Hello and welcome. I'm Mamta and I'm here with
Emily
and Evan.
Based on the interviews we have done, we came to the conclusion that technology plays a crucial role in our everyday lives.
Everyone uses similar technology, such as iPhones and headphones.
We can also conclude that to some people, they feel that these technologies disconnect them from nature, while in contrast, others feel it brings them closer.
Either way, technology is affecting our relationship with nature, whether we realize it or not.
Yeah, every technology that we use mediates our relationship and connection to nature.
Technology also determines the way we know nature and shapes how we view it.
Exactly. Throughout our world's history, as technology evolved, so did humanity's relationship with nature. Humans started by directly living off the land, living in harmony with nature. However, as we began to evolve as humans, so did the technology we created. We created more and more forms of technology that served as a way to improve our quality of life. As we invented more and more things, our relationship with nature changed drastically. We no longer lived directly at our environment, but instead learned to exploit it of its resources for its own personal gain. Through this process, we have become further and further away from our original connection to nature. We are now going to go into specific detail on what changed our world and the connection to nature and the story of our Earth's evolution. Up until today's technological issues with nature, Emily, would you like to explain?
Hello and welcome. I'm Mamta and I'm here with
Emily
and Evan.
Based on the interviews we have done, we came to the conclusion that technology plays a crucial role in our everyday lives.
Everyone uses similar technology, such as iPhones and headphones.
We can also conclude that to some people, they feel that these technologies disconnect them from nature, while in contrast, others feel it brings them closer.
Either way, technology is affecting our relationship with nature, whether we realize it or not.
Yeah, every technology that we use mediates our relationship and connection to nature.
Technology also determines the way we know nature and shapes how we view it.
Exactly. Throughout our world's history, as technology evolved, so did humanity's relationship with nature. Humans started by directly living off the land, living in harmony with nature. However, as we began to evolve as humans, so did the technology we created. We created more and more forms of technology that served as a way to improve our quality of life. As we invented more and more things, our relationship with nature changed drastically. We no longer lived directly at our environment, but instead learned to exploit it of its resources for its own personal gain. Through this process, we have become further and further away from our original connection to nature. We are now going to go into specific detail on what changed our world and the connection to nature and the story of our Earth's evolution. Up until today's technological issues with nature, Emily, would you like to explain?
Well, you coming?
So basically, railroads were a key technology that revolutionized the United States in the 19th century. From the time when the railroads were first constructed in the late 1820s to when the Transcontinental Railroad was finished in the 1860s, weeks' worth of travel was turning into days, and days into hours. The entire livelihood of the country was sped up through this traveling system.
This seems pretty quick. What else did railroads do to benefit our world?
So basically, railroads were able to overcome issues like terrain and weather that held back previous means of transportation. They shielded from the snow, the rain, the ice, and made traveling possible through nature's harsh conditions. They also combated any terrain. Railroads would run right through mountains and over hills, making transportation as efficient as possible. In return, industry picked up and relied on railroads for their shipment, similar to how humans relied on railroads for travel. With this new technology, the United States was completely changed. People believed it was some sort of miracle, that it was better than any laws or even a supernatural power. It also paved the way for even more technologies.
Wow. What else did railroads do?
So basically, universal time evolved from the technology of railroads. At this time, all sections of the United States functioned on slightly different times that were extremely hard to keep track of. As a result, many railroad accidents occurred from trains running at the same time. In order to solve this problem, four standard time zones were developed. The creation of time zones was a direct result from industrialization through the railroads. With railroad time, known today as standardized time, the entire country was united under a fixed schedule. It forced everyone to be on schedule and on time, and weeded out those who weren't.
So, what was this relationship to nature?
Basically, now, instead of noon being when the sun was in the middle of the sky, it was when the clock struck 12. This separated humans from nature even more, starting with the railroads and transitioning into time. Basically, we've learned that innovation leads to a positive feedback loop. More innovation and more inventions lead to more and more. The railroad leading to time is just a prime example. This is a common theme in human history that inventions lead to more and more inventions, and then humans learn to rely on them. This has occurred with various things, most recently the creation of AI. While AI is beginning to revolutionize our world, there are many drawbacks, such as its environmental impacts, which we will dive deeper into now with an interview from Professor Kyle. We are here today with Professor Kyle Keeler, an environmental studies and science professor at Lafayette College.
First off, most people probably don't know of the environmental effects that come with the use of AI because it is so far removed. Can you tell us what effects you know AI has on nature and our environment?
I think the most well-known one is probably water use, right? So if you think about what ChatGPT, for example, uses in terms of its training, it's multiple Olympic-sized swimming pools. And a lot of this is fresh water. And we're living in a world where many people around the world don't have access to fresh. Additionally, if you're using ChatGPT, you're pretty much dumping now a bottle of water for every 30 back and forths you have.
How do you think AI mediates our connection to nature?
So, I mean, I think that the biggest way that it does that is it makes us think of these projects as disconnected from the rest of our physical lives, from our connection to this land that we're on, from our connection to the air that we all breathe, from the connection to the water that we all drink, when in reality, it's all connected. You cannot escape it, whether it's the water that we drink, whether it's the land that we're on, or whether it's the air that we breathe, because we live in a closed system, right? We know that the earth, from the atmosphere to the land
to the water, to the air, affects all of us, and we live in this closed loop. When I type something into ChatGPT and it spits out an answer, I don't think about those connections, right? But it's very much in the way that I just described, connected to every single part of our earth and every single one of us. So it divorces us from that while still being grounded in every single part of our physical environmental lives.
How have you firsthand experienced AI being brought up in your classes and your work?
Well, I think the most obvious way is I can't escape it right now. The thing that scares me the most is people using it to, at the most extreme, write an entire paper. On the lesser end, but still in effect, using it to brainstorm.
Do you believe the benefits from AI are going to outweigh the environmental consequences?
Absolutely not. Because I don't think the AI is useful for much of what it's being sold for. I think the AI is useful if you have a massive amount of data that you have to parse through. Many of us don't have massive amounts of data that we have to parse through. If that was the only use of AI, we wouldn't have the environmental cost of AI that we're seeing scale up every single day. And that's a problem. So I do not think the benefits of AI are going to outweigh the environmental costs. In fact, I think it's exactly the opposite.
What do you think we can do to effectively mediate AI and make sure it is being used in a helpful and not harmful way?
I think we should all not use it. I don't think anyone should be using it. I think that it's going to continue to be forced on us because that's how many of these products are forced on us, right? Sometimes we can't escape them because of the structures and systems that underlie them. Sam Altman's obsession with growth, having partnerships with national governments that have obsessions with growth, right? But the most effective thing that we can do is stop using them in any way that we can refuse them, right? I don't use Google anymore. Plus, Google's just gotten worse because it puts ads up at the top of each search, right? So I'm consistently trying to find avenues and ways to refuse AI and refuse it being forced upon.
Thank you, Dr. Keeler, for the interview. And I think that he brings up a lot of great points about AI. And I think AI is one of the biggest technologies being used in our everyday lives. And it impacts all of us, especially the younger generation, but as well as people in the workforce. People write emails using AI, and it disconnects them from other humans. Even people in the government are using AI to do simple tasks. And he brings up a lot of great points of why this is an issue on a deeper level, in environmental level. One of the first reasons why Dr. Keeler believes AI is bad is because of the water usage, right? It uses mass amounts of water. He said every 30 back and forth is one bottle of water being dumped out. I think the bigger issue here is it's using fresh water, right? And we have people around the world, in the United States, for example, volunteering their time, building wells in Africa, which is awesome. It's great to do that. But how can we cut down on our uses of AI to help use that fresh water to maybe help get clean water to people who need it? Because it's a big issue around the world, not only just in Africa, but in poorer communities in the United States. And I think us using that fresh water for our own benefits is really selfish in a way, right? We're using this because we want to take the easy way out sometimes. We want AI to do the shortcut. We want AI to write that email when we could just have a human connection and just write the email ourselves. But no, we're being selfish. We're using AI, and it's hurting us at a deeper level with the energy consumption that it takes, but also the water that it takes to power it. AI is interesting because not only does it affect the environment, but it also hurts the development of our brains, and it disconnects us from the people in our lives, right? It creates this closed system, as he was talking about, where we never actually are able to think critically. Rather, for even the littlest things like brainstorming, where our brain needs to work through those complex problems. You know, it builds our brain. It helps us engage with people. It's great to talk to people. Go down the hall and talk to your neighbor and ask them about a problem and ask them how might they go about solving it. But no, we want to just use ChatGPT right away, or a form of AI where it's taking that out, right? There's office hours for a reason in college, and I think too many students are not using those office hours wisely. Instead, they're just going to chat for an answer that might frankly not be correct. As humans, we have navigated through time creating new inventions that have always benefited us as humans, right? No, we haven't really thought of many ways where we can give back to the environment, because time and time again, whether it's with trains, we're thinking about ourselves. How can we navigate this world easier, and how can we better human society? But within that, we are tearing down the environment. We are hurting animals and plants, and we are making it worse in the future. And so we need to start thinking about ways that we can use technology to help better the world, right? What inventions are we going to make to help give back to the place that has given us so much? How can we help clean the air? How can we help clean the water? How can we help get the CO2 out of the environment, right? There's so many different ways so many ways the environment needs help, so many ways nature needs help from us. And I think that we should start thinking about how can we help and give back to our Earth, rather than how can we help ourselves.
Thank you to everyone for sharing your perspectives and ideas on how we can better understand nature. Nature truly is remarkable, something outside of human creation. The ways we interact with it differ. However, when we gain a holistic view of it, it can truly change the way we see the world around us. Although this is a busy time of the year, I urge you to go out, explore the world around you, take a moment out of your day to go outside, take a walk, get some fresh air, learn about your surroundings, and see how it's influenced by nature. Before wrapping up, I wanted to shout out our sensational guide in helping us truly know nature, Professor Carlin. You have provided us with a plethora of materials and perspectives that have shaped a new view of nature in all of us, and have always encouraged us to dig deeper to see how nature is the root of virtually everything we interact with, literally and figuratively, and we are very grateful for your consistent support. Thank you so much for listening. I hope this podcast inspires you to be one with the natural world and see nature in everything, not just science, art, food, religion, technology, and personal experiences, but also everywhere that you look.